It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. You've probably racked up at least a few regrets in your life. They might be small things, like wishing you left earlier when you're running late for something. Or they could be bigger things, like wishing you had the courage to ask someone out, or that you chose a different career. Our next guest says those regrets are a core part of what makes us human. He says if we understand regret better, we can actually use it to our advantage. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Hey, if you're willing to share, do you have a regret that's been hard for you to let go of? Or have you been able to take a regret and learn from it for the next time? Have you learned things from your regrets over time? How have they changed the way you act now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Daniel Pink is a New York Times bestselling author. His latest book is The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, you lay this out right off the bat in your book. A lot of people love the concept of no regrets. Some of us even get it tattooed on ourselves. Why does this no regret idea become so widespread?
Well, I think it's because we're a little bit over-indexed on positivity. We think that we need to be positive all the time. We think that we should be looking forward all the time, that we should never look back, that when we experience a negative emotion, or particularly a negative emotion like regret, we should brush it off, think positive, and move on. And the trouble with that philosophy, that no regrets philosophy, is that it runs against 50 years of science, and it's a terrible blueprint for living.
Why? Why is that a terrible blueprint for living?
Well, because regrets serve a function. Here's the thing. Regret is one of our most ubiquitous emotions. It is one of the most common emotions human beings have. It's arguably the most common negative emotion human beings have. There's 50 years of evidence showing that the only people who truly don't have regrets, right, who actually are true to this no regrets philosophy are five-year-olds because their brains haven't developed enough. People with certain kinds of brain lesions and neurodegenerative disorders, and sociopaths. The rest of us have regrets. And, you know, I don't like experiencing regret. Nobody does. So there's this puzzle about why is something so unpleasant, so widespread? And the reason is it's useful if we treat it right. And the problem is we haven't been taught how to treat it right. We think of it as something to ignore. When we can't ignore our regrets, we end up wallowing them. What we should be doing is confronting our regrets, thinking about them, using them as engines of progress.
All right. How do we do that? I look back at some of my life. I regret, A, I probably don't want to think about it. As you say, B, if I start thinking about it, I wallow in it. How do I steer that better course?
We have a lot of evidence on how to do that more effectively. It begins with how we think about ourselves and our regret. When we talk to ourselves in the face of missteps and screw-ups, we are brutal. Our self-talk is vicious and cruel, and the solution to that is stop doing that. Instead, practice something called self-compassion. Self-compassion is treating yourself with kindness rather than contempt, recognizing that your regrets are part of the human condition. You're actually not that special. If you have a regret about kindness or lack of boldness, it's very, very common. And also our mistakes are a moment in time, not the full measure of our life. And so once we treat ourselves with self-compassion, we can begin to talk about our regret, make sense of our regret, and systematically extract a lesson from it that we can apply next time.
Talking to Daniel Pink about his new book, The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. You can join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Is there something in your life that you regret and that you're willing to share? Do you feel like you wallow in it? Do you try to forget about it? Or have you learned from it? Do you have questions for a guest about this, the science of regret? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dan, you've done these massive surveys, first in the United States, then a worldwide one looking at regret. What are some of the most common big regrets that people express in these surveys?
Well, what I found and actually look at, so thank you for mentioning that. So I did one big giant public opinion poll of the U.S. population that showed that when you look at sort of the main areas of people's lives, people regret a lot of different kinds of stuff. They have regrets about careers. They have regrets about education. They have regrets about health. But then I also did something called the World Regret Survey, where I just collected regrets, a lot. We now have over 20,000 regrets from people in 109 countries. And what I found there, when you actually go beyond the domains of life, and I read through the first 15,000 of these, is that around the world, over and over again, people seem to share the same four regrets. Over and over again, they express the same four regrets. They have less to do with the part of life you're in, career, education, whatever, and more to do with, I think, some fundamental human longings and aspirations.
What are those main longings and aspirations that that will lead us into this path of regret?
Well, I'll go through them very quickly. Foundation regrets. Foundation regrets are, if only I'd done the work. These are people who have regrets about saving too little, spending too much, about not taking care of their health, about not working hard enough in school. Again, small decisions early that add up to calamitous consequences later. Second category, boldness regrets. Boldness regrets are, if only I'd taken the chance. Again, this spans the domains of life. You mentioned one at the top of the show, Rob. Well, a lot of people regret not asking somebody out on a date. But these are people who regret not traveling, people who regret not starting a business, people who regret not speaking up. They're at a moment in their life when they can play it safe or take the chance. They don't take the chance, not always, but often they regret it. Third category, moral regrets. If only I'd done the right thing. These are regrets about bullying, marital infidelity, other kinds of transgressions. And finally, the fourth category, connection regrets. If only I'd reached out. They're relationships, it's regrets about relationships that have come apart or should have been intact or were intact and are no longer intact. And somebody wants to reach out, but they say it's going to be awkward. The other side's not going to care. And so they don't do it, and it drifts apart further. And with remarkable regularity, people express these same four regrets.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jake is with us in Appleton. Jake, hello.
I have a question. What can we do, or what are some mechanisms when we find ourselves loathing, maybe in some of these regretful type thoughts? Any help for your viewers or listeners, rather? Thanks.
Sure. Sure, Jake. So as I was mentioning earlier, one of the best things you can do is to stop. The first thing is to stop that march toward rumination. And the way to do that is to treat yourself with the same generosity and kindness and empathy you would treat somebody else. If a friend of you came to you and said, "Oh, Jake, I made this mistake," you typically wouldn't say, "You idiot! What's wrong with you? You're the worst person in the world." But that's how we talk to ourselves. And as I said before, don't do that. Treat yourself with kindness. Recognize that these mistakes, these regrets are part of the human condition. The second thing you can do, and it's really important, is to talk about it or write about the regret. When we talk about a regret or write about it, we unburden ourselves. What's more, we do something profoundly important for negative emotions. We take this abstraction, this blobby negative feeling, convert it to words. And then that's far less fearsome. These concrete words are less fearsome than the abstract emotion. And finally, we have to draw a lesson from it. We have to be explicitly draw a lesson from it. And a good way to do that is to get some removed from it and ask yourself, what would I tell my best friend to do in this situation? Or what would I want to have done 10 years from now? And so when we reframe inward and treat ourselves with kindness, when we express outward and make sense of it, and then when we move forward by drawing a lesson from it, we can begin to develop a habit of using our regrets as an engine for progress. And when we do that, there is a massive amount of evidence that it helps us in profoundly important ways. I mean, even in more reductively narrow ways, it helps us become better negotiators. It helps us become better problem solvers. It helps us become better parents. The problem is no one has taught us how to do that. And it's a very simple process.
Thanks for that question, Jake. We're talking to author Daniel Pink. His new book is called The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you try to live your life with no regrets? How is that working for you? Or have you made a point of learning from regrets, things that you see as mistakes in your past and trying to get it better the next time around? Or do you have questions about how all this regret stuff works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with author Daniel Pink about his latest book, The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. You could join in to share regrets you've had, how you've overcome them or dealt with them, or your questions about regret. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Joel on Facebook writes, "We cannot change the past, but we can certainly learn from it. Holding on to regrets or resentments destroys our ability to enjoy today." What do you think? Share your thoughts. Dan, something that struck me in your book, you share a lot of regrets that people shared in your surveys. One story that really stuck with me when it comes to Joel's comment about learning from our regrets, a woman who talked about regretting that she hadn't listened to her grandparents more, enjoyed time spent with them until it was too late, they'd passed away. She took that, though, and said, okay, as my parents age, I'm going to make sure to listen, and I'm going to make sure to take that time. Can you talk about that as an example of how we can use our regret?
Sure. It's a great story. This is a woman named Abby who lives in Phoenix, Arizona. And when she was growing up, her grandparents, who lived in Indiana, would come and visit for a couple of months a year to, you know, because Arizona winters are far more pleasant than Indiana winters. And when she was a kid, she hated it. She resented them being there. And then they passed away and she realized she had screwed up. And what she missed was the connection, the stories. And what she decided to do is, again, this is a great example. She could ignore it, say, no regrets, no regrets. Look positive, be positive, look forward, right? Or she could say, oh my God, I'm a horrible human being. This is the worst thing that anybody's ever done. Instead, she said, oh, I feel bad. That negative feeling is a signal. It's a signal about what I value and it's a signal about what I should do next. And so she has begun systematically collecting the stories of her parents, who I think are in their early 70s at this point, making an effort to collect their stories and assemble their stories. And so she has that sense of meaning. She has that sense of purpose. And it's a good example of the best way to deal with regrets, which is to use them as information, as data, as signals.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Randy is with us in Adams. Randy, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Randy?
Well, I just think another word for regret is forgiveness. You have to learn to forgive yourself. Because most people that have regrets, it's because it's their something that they have done and that they should have done. And if they learn to forgive themselves, they can work towards, like, say you said something bad to a friend or something and you regret it, and then it just eats at you and eats at you. You got to forgive yourself for saying it, and then maybe you can go to your friend and apologize.
Randy, thanks a lot for sharing that. Dan, what do you think about the forgiveness part of this?
No, I think Randy makes a great point. I mean, what she is calling forgiveness is an aspect of self-compassion, which is, you know, treat yourself as generously as you would treat somebody else. You know, the other thing that that Randy mentions is a pretty interesting distinction in the architecture of regret, which is regrets of action and regrets of inaction. Regrets about something that I did and regrets about something that I didn't do. So for things like, let's say you said something terrible to your friend, to use Randy's example, that's a regret of action. You can actually sometimes make repairs on those. You can apologize. You can make amends. You can make restitution. What's interesting is that what lives with people far longer than regrets of action are regrets of inaction. As we age, regrets of inaction, regrets about what we didn't do, outnumber regrets of action by about 2-1.
Randy, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Daniel Pink about his book, The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. Still time for you to share your thoughts, your stories, your questions at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Dan, a thing that really strikes me here is a lot of the regrets, not all of them, but a lot of them are kind of, we become science fiction authors and craft the alternate history. What if I had gone to school or hadn't gone to school or married this person instead of that person or whatever, and our alternate history is way better than the one we're really living. How do we get over that one?
Well, it's an interesting question, because sometimes our alternate history is way better than the one we're living in now. But I think what really eats at people is not knowing what that alternate history was, and also not delivering at the moment. So, for instance, I have a lot of people who regret not asking, as we talked earlier, not asking somebody out on a date or something like that. But very few of them say, oh, if I had asked him out on a date, we would be married and have three kids and, you know, living, a beautiful life in Milwaukee. They're not saying that. What's gnawing at them is, in that particular case, is not stepping up at the moment of being at a juncture in their lives and having a chance to do something bold and shrinking from that chance. Now, you're right that the way we think about regret is to conjure these alternative histories. But what seems to bug people about a lot of these inaction regrets is not so much the outcome, but the decision itself.
Now, one thing about your four main buckets of regret, the foundation one, where I wish I'd taken better care of myself, planned for my financial future, and so on, it seems sometimes to contrast with the boldness one. I wish I'd taken that chance. I wish I'd done this thing on the spur of the moment. How do we reconcile those two? The I wish I'd taken more risks versus I wish I'd hedged my bets better.
Yeah, that's a good question. The things that people did, I actually think there's actually a very close affinity between having a stable foundation and having a psychologically rich life. I think that having a stable foundation allows you to take sensible choices. The foundation regrets that people were talking about were not, you know, when they spent money, they were spending money on frivolities. They weren't saying, oh, I tried to start a business and it failed, and therefore I'm in bad financial shape. I don't think I had anybody who said that. I had people who said, I earned an okay income, but I spent it going out to restaurants and buying cars and stuff that I didn't need. So the foundation regrets were very rarely a trade-off with boldness. They were something different. They were about kind of investments in oneself. It's not like people were being overly risky in compromising their foundation. They were being actually stupid in many cases. And when you have at least a stable foundation, that gives you a little bit more of the temerity to take that trip, to try something more adventurous.
We heard from Dean on the Ideas Network Facebook page, who writes, regrets equal fear of the past, worry equals fear of the future. Mm. Live in the now, Dean concludes. Easier said than done for me, Dan. I don't know. Is that normal?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not terrible advice, but I think that one of the things that you see in some of the research on the temporal side of human development and human flourishing is that what we want is in some ways an integration of the past, present, and future. What we want is we want the past to inform our present, and we want the present to guide our future. There is a very interesting personality psychologist at Northwestern University in fairly nearby Evanston, Illinois, and he says that people see their lives in terms of narratives, and there are two kinds of narratives. That he says, Dan McAdams is the guy's name. He says there are contamination narratives where things go from good to bad, and there are redemption narratives where things go from bad to good. And humans seem to flourish when they see their lives as redemption narratives. And the downside of living in the present only is that it's not a narrative. It is simply, you know, processing this particular moment and not seeing how it integrates into one's past, present, and future. And we know healthy flourishing depends, at least in part, on seeing your life in this narrative terms of making progress, of getting better, of moving from bad to good.
Dan, you talk at the end of your book about, this isn't just research you've done for research's sake. It has started to seep into your life. How has your long look at regret changed your own personal behavior?
Well, on these connection regrets, I have to say it's changed it significantly. So what happens with these connection regrets is that people have these relationships, often friendships, usually not, I'm not talking about romantic relationships mostly. I think about a friendship, and the friendship comes apart. And usually they come apart in profoundly undramatic ways. They drift apart. And one side wants to reach out and they say, nope, it's going to be awkward if I reach out, and the other side's not going to care. So it drifts apart more and it feels more awkward, and they think the other side's not going to care less. And they're wrong. There's a pile of evidence showing that that reaching out is far less awkward than you think, and the other side almost always welcomes it. And so for me, it's like if I'm at a juncture where I'm saying, should I reach out or should I not reach out? Being at that juncture has answered my question. I mean, always, you know, reach out. If you're at that juncture, reach out. And that's changed me, because I'm not somebody who is like super social or super, you know, really good at reaching out. But this changed my view on it, because I had those misguided views of awkwardness and the suspicion that the other side wouldn't care. And I was flatly wrong.
Well, now, apart from reaching out, Dan, in our last minute or so, leave us with a bit of advice on how to start using regret in a happier way.
Yeah, well, I mean, what I would suggest with people is this. This week, have a conversation with someone about your regret. People want to talk about this. Tell somebody around a dinner table, in your office, hey, here's a regret that I have. Here's what I've learned from it. And here's what I'm going to do about it going forward. That simple process. Here's my regret. Here's what I learned. Here's what I'm going to do about it. That will trigger one of the richer conversations that you will have this year. I can almost guarantee it. It's a topic people want to talk about. It's a topic that we've made taboo, but it's a topic that can yield very powerful lessons in what we value and how we should lead a meaningful life.
Dan, thanks so much for sharing your research with us.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Daniel Pink. He's the author of a bunch of books. He was with us today to talk about his latest. It's called The Power of Regret, How Looking Backward Moves Us Forward. You can find a link to information about the book at WPR.org/Central Time. And if you have thoughts on regret, maybe an experience to share yourself, there's still time. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, more men are leaving the workforce to be stay-at-home dads, while more women are serving as household breadwinners. We'll explore what's causing that trend and how families are managing it. First, the synthetic opioid fentanyl is the leading cause of death for Americans aged 18 to 49, according to a Washington Post analysis. The Wisconsin Department of Health Services said that in 2021, more than 1,000 people died of a fentanyl overdose, a 97% increase from 2019. The U.S. government is working to end the threat of the fentanyl crisis, but a new investigative series finds missteps along the way from multiple presidential administrations. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered fentanyl in your life? Yourself, someone in your family, or are you a first responder, a healthcare provider? What are you seeing in your community? Do you have questions about how this drug, the synthetic drug, rose so quickly to become such a big problem? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Nick Miroff covers the Department of Homeland Security as a reporter for The Washington Post. He and his colleagues are in the midst of a multi-part series on the rise of the fentanyl problem. Nick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. Glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
I mentioned just one statistic there. Can you talk about what a dominant force fentanyl has become when it comes to overdoses here in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, it's really staggering. Last year, more than 107,000 Americans died of drug overdoses. About two-thirds of those were caused by fentanyl. That is the highest figure ever. And as you mentioned, fentanyl is now the leading cause of death for Americans 18 to 49. It kills more people in the United States each year than suicides, gun violence, even car accidents. It's just an incredible, you know, wave of death that has risen extremely quickly. And one of the things we found in the course of reporting this series is that, you know, during the pandemic, these numbers got significantly worse. Just since 2019, fatal overdoses from fentanyl in the United States are up 94%. So there, you know, it's a lot to unpack. But I think, you know, just for, you know, the scope of this thing and the magnitude of the losses were the thing that really inspired us to want to dig into this and, you know, try to bring more attention to it.
What is it about fentanyl? Now, it was originally invented, I've talked about this on the show before, as something that you might use post-surgically, that had a legitimate use. What is it, since it's been replicated illegally in so many cases now, what is it about its concentration, its nature, its portability that's made it such a lucrative drug for the illegal industry?
Sure. No, I mean, you're absolutely right. It still has legitimate medical purposes. It was created as a very, you know, powerful painkiller. It's still used in a medical context under, you know, controlled circumstances. Some people have probably heard of fentanyl patches that release the drug very slowly. So for people with terminal illnesses, it can be, you know, really important treatment. What we're talking about is illegal fentanyl manufactured by Mexican drug trafficking organizations. And, you know, to tell this story, you got to look back to the first wave of opioid addiction in the United States that many of your listeners will be familiar with, really driven by the U.S. opioid industry, Purdue Pharma, OxyContin. I think, you know, a lot of people know this story. And when the DEA and other U.S. law enforcement cracked down on those companies and manufacturers, it created a big vacuum in the market. And, you know, people initially turned to heroin that was being trafficked by Mexican cartels. But the cartels quickly figured out that they could manufacture illegal fentanyl. It's cheaper. They don't need to control huge tracts of land. They don't need to have farmers growing, you know, opium poppies. They don't need to worry about the seasons. With the right chemicals and someone who knows how to make it in a makeshift lab, you can create huge quantities of this stuff. And so the price for street level fentanyl has just gone way, way down. And now on the streets of cities like San Diego, where we set our first story, you know, you can buy a fake oxycodone pill that's really a fentanyl pill manufactured by Mexican cartels. Those pills sell for $4 or $5 a hit. So, you know, just the cost of addiction has gone way down, even as the potency of these drugs has grown and far, far more people are now addicted.
One running theme and one of your pieces in this series is Washington, the DEA, presidential administrations always being a step behind this, it seemed like. By the time, as you mentioned, it moved on to heroin, we're still looking at prescription drugs. We're looking at heroin, now fentanyl's coming from China. We're looking at China, now it's coming, as it is today, from Mexico. Can you talk a little bit about why it seems like the response has been behind the curve?
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, I think it'd be really easy to say, oh, the Mexican cartels are really, you know, inventive and resourceful and difficult to defeat. And so I think a lot of people have been accustomed to thinking about this as just this kind of, you know, misfortune that has, you know, occurred in the United States. But what we've tried to do is go back and look at, you know, what were the missteps and mistakes that led up to this. And, you know, it goes back over multiple administrations. And, the Obama administration, you know, initially viewed fentanyl as, you know, less of a threat than heroin. They treated it basically as this kind of, you know, additive that would be used to enhance heroin. This was a time when they demoted the drug czar's position and were generally getting away from, you know, some of the more law enforcement heavy responses. And then, you know, during the Trump administration, we saw, you know, the Department of Homeland Security channeling $11 billion into building a border wall. But, you know, what we know now is that the border wall is virtually useless for stopping fentanyl trafficking, because the vast majority of this illegal fentanyl that's coming into the country is arriving in passenger vehicles and commercial trucks. It's going right through the official ports of entry, hidden by smugglers inside these vehicles. It's not being carried by migrants through the desert or anything like that. And so what we're seeing right now on the border is just vast quantities being seized almost every day, millions of pills. They call them blues. They're these blue fake oxycodone tablets that the cartels are just cranking out on this industrial scale and sending across the border. And if a percentage of them gets confiscated by U.S. Customs and Border Protection, well, they just sort of shrug that off as the cost of doing business. So as the drugs, you know, are flooding into the country, the price is going down. And, you know, there's very little hope right now that, you know, that we're on the verge of turning any kind of corner. And so I think, you know, most of the people we talked to for the series feel like this problem is going to continue to get worse until, you know, maybe it gets better.
Talking to Nick Miroff from The Washington Post, he and his colleagues are in the midst of a multi-part series on the rise of fentanyl and fentanyl overdoses in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If this is affecting your life, you, a family member, a loved one, if you are a healthcare provider or work as a in a police department as a first responder, love to hear what you are seeing. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls. Steve joins us now in Wisconsin Rapids. Steve, hi.
Hello, I'm a trucker, and I've been all over this country, and I'm telling you the reality of the situation. They're bringing it across the state border due to this open door policy. Not only is it coming in trucks and vehicles, but it's being moved throughout the United States by truckers. We have so many foreigners driving trucks that don't even speak English. They're dangerous. I mean, I'm a trucker. We used to have to worry about four-wheelers. Now we got to worry about these 18-wheelers because they're dangerous. The government let them get CDLs. They're moving drugs across the country, and the FBI ain't stopping them.
Steve, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Nick, what do we know? You were just starting to talk about how drugs are actually crossing the border at legal ports of entry. What do we know about how they're coming into the country and then making their way from places like San Diego to places like Wisconsin?
Yeah, well, the vast majority of the illegal fentanyl is coming through those official crossings in the San Diego area and in southern Arizona, namely Nogales. They come across and then they go to stash houses in Los Angeles and Phoenix and Las Vegas, where cartel transportation cells essentially divide them up and bring them to wholesalers, distribute them to wholesalers across the country. And you're probably saying this sounds like, you know, the way that any industry would handle distribution. And that's right. I mean, these cartels are essentially dark, evil pharmaceutical companies that are, that are operating many of in very similar fashion. And so once they bring the product to those to cities around the United States, then wholesalers will sell them to, more retail level dealers. And that's how fentanyl gets, distributed down to the street level. But I'll give you one incredible fact that we learned in the course of investigating this series. Right now, for example, in Arizona, the price of a single fentanyl tablet, the one that I just said costs, $4 or $5 on the street. Well, the wholesale price in Arizona is down to about 50 cents per tablet. And that's a lethal dose of fentanyl to someone who doesn't have an opioid habit or tolerance. That's how cheap it is.
Looking at prevention efforts, we had cooperation for a while between the Drug Enforcement Agency, you write, and the Mexican government. The current Mexican president, Lopez Obrador, put an end to a lot of that, saying, hey, violence has been going up in Mexico since we started this. The fentanyl problem in the U.S. has been going up, too. It's not working. What's the current state of cooperation between the U.S. and Mexico?
Yeah, this is a really key part of the whole story. Basically, the U.S.-Mexico drug war partnership fell apart in late 2018, right as fentanyl was taking off. And that has been, one more factor driving this explosion of fatal overdoses. For about 10 years, the United States and Mexico worked closer than ever together under this thing called the Merida Initiative that some of your listeners will remember. And that involved, U.S. intelligence, not only the DEA, but, other U.S. agencies working closely with Mexico's armed forces to really go after the cartels and take down drug bosses like, El Chapo Guzman. And so, this partnership was essentially the framework for a decade. It was highly flawed. And when Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the current president of Mexico, he was running for office in 2018, he basically, rejected this agreement and ran on, the idea. One of the ideas was that, that this way of fighting the drug war was not working. It wasn't bringing down violence and it wasn't really doing anything to bring down drug use. And he was, on that front, he was correct. But by going in a different direction right at this moment, it put a rift into the cooperation between the two countries. It gave the cartels an advantage. And if you talk to DEA agents today, they will say that that was a major setback to U.S. operations, and that has also, you know, been one of the factors that has them, you know, trying to play catch up to get, back ahead of this thing.
We're talking to Washington Post reporter Nick Miroff about an investigative series on the rise of the fentanyl crisis. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you seeing this problem in your own community, in your own family, workplace? Call 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the economics of fentanyl, how it's made, how it ends up in the United States? 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation with Nick Miroff, Washington Post reporter, looking at a post-investigative series on the rise of the fentanyl crisis in the U.S. You can join in at 800-642-1234 to share your own experiences, your questions, 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Back to your calls now. Martha is with us in Menominee. Martha, hi.
Hey, Rob. Another great show. Thanks so much. Hey, I'd really like to thank your host for dispelling the myth that migrants and refugee seekers and asylum seekers are walking across the border carrying these drugs. Your host has shown that that's not the case. They're coming in through border crossings in trucks. So my question is, how bad this fentanyl epidemic, how much of this can be traced back to people desperate for pain relief that can't get, opioids through their regular doctors, because that system seemed to have gotten shut down. So I'm just curious about that, if there are any numbers that can go back to that.
Martha, thanks for the call. Nick, I remember conversations on the show when we were getting more heroin, as you mentioned. And part of the story there was people who had been using pain relievers, often prescribed by doctors, that's cut off, and then they turn to something like heroin. Is that still part of the story now with fentanyl?
Yeah, that is absolutely part of the story. I mean, the same, wave of addiction preceded fentanyl, and what we've seen is that fentanyl has almost entirely replaced heroin in the illegal narcotics market. In some cities you can't even find fentanyl anymore. And initially, whereas some users were wanting heroin and then getting introduced to fentanyl, now what we're told is that people who are, habitual opioid users are just seeking out fentanyl because it's so much more potent. But your caller is absolutely right. I mean, the origins of this go back to the prescription opioids epidemic. A lot of people were left needing, these narcotics in order to avoid withdrawal symptoms. They turned to heroin and now they've turned to fentanyl. But I'll just make one more point, which is that another thing we've seen is that supply creates its own demand. I think it's a lot of people easily dismiss this as a matter of a demand for narcotics in the United States and that the cartels are satisfying. But one of the things that, we've seen, you look at this, is that a huge abundance of supply and drugs being so cheap and dealers using fentanyl to enhance the potency of other things like methamphetamines, cocaine, other drugs that people are buying in the market, all of that grows the potential pool of customers for these trafficking organizations. And that's one of the main reasons we've seen the number of people using drugs and dying now from fentanyl increase.
Martha, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Mike joins us next in Madison. Mike, hello.
Hi. So about 10 years ago, researchers down in Chile were looking into a vaccine for alcohol where you could give a shot and 6 months of results, you wouldn't want to drink any alcohol. I heard they're working on a vaccine possibly for fentanyl. I don't know if that would also include heroin, but it might be something that you would consider as a parent having your children vaccinated. Have you any information on that?
Thanks for the call, Mike. Nick, have you encountered anything like that in your reporting?
Only the coverage that we've read. I know that this is something that they're working on, but From what I understand, and from what you know, we're told this is the kind of thing that isn't close to being ready to, you know, to roll out. I think it's still in the experimental phase. But I think that, you know, public health agencies as well as the community, medical community, would welcome something like this. Would welcome any intervention that holds the promise that you know, carries the possibility of being able to break the cycle of addiction that so many people are gripped with.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Nick, as we've mentioned, this is a problem that rose over the course of various presidential administrations, Democrats and Republicans. What are you seeing in the latest efforts now from the Biden administrations when it comes to fentanyl?
Well, one thing we've seen is that is a renewed focus from the DEA under the Biden administration. You know, prior to the current DEA administrator, Ann Milgram, getting in there, getting confirmed by the Senate last year, the DEA went through a series of temporary acting leaders. They had, you know, between 2015 and 2021, there were five different agency heads. That's one of the things that led to the kind of sense of turmoil at the agency. All of this occurring while fentanyl was really taking off. So we've seen the Biden administration really renew its focus or put its focus on fentanyl. It's got a campaign called One Pill Can Kill, and Administrator Milgram talks about you know, the agency's efforts to really target the two top Mexican drug trafficking organizations, the Sinaloa cartel and the Jalisco cartel, to target them and their financial networks abroad. So I think you're seeing more of a law enforcement effort, and you know, there's a new push for more treatment funding and any number of other interventions aimed at trying to both discourage people from using fentanyl or experimenting with fentanyl, but also providing treatment for people who are addicted. I think the message is getting through, and I do think there is, you know, a bipartisan momentum that we've seen for more action as people start to, you know, realize just how massive this wave of fatal overdoses is.
And when it comes to border enforcement now, as you mentioned, port of entries, people are driving a vehicle in, smuggling this. Not many vehicles get searched. Cartels are willing to accept a certain amount of loss. Are there efforts to step up how many vehicles get screened or use technology to do it more efficiently?
There is. There's an effort underway to increase scanning technology in the both in sophistication and in the percentage of vehicles that get scanned. CBP just in the past year has added some of this new equipment at several of the major ports, but it's going to take several years, and the, you know, the effort is behind. I mean, you know, as one congressional staffer we spoke to talked about, you know, even back in 2018, there was a recognition that the U.S. government needed what, you know, what she called a Manhattan Project to try to, you know, to try to confront the severity of this threat. And it's really only in the last year or so that we've started to see these new scanning systems come online, and it's going to take many more years. And, you know, right now we're right in the middle of this crisis, and this is the equipment that's badly needed, and it's just not ready to deploy yet.
And just in our last half a minute, is there a focus on addiction treatment so that users of whatever kind of drug don't get exposed to their product adulterated with fentanyl?
Yeah, I mean, you know, some of these things are controversial. You know, fentanyl test strips, some universities have started to give them out so that that the students who are thinking of experimenting with drugs or using drugs would be able to test them, to swab them, to make sure that they don't contain illegal fentanyl, because as we know, that's been a you know, one of the drivers of these overdose deaths, is that you know, someone thinks they're buying a Xanax or an Adderall or using cocaine, and they're, you know, these things are laced with fentanyl, and then the person dies because they have no opioid tolerance. So, you know, test strips, treatment, you know, I think there are a number of experimental, you know, treatments out there, and generally just a real desperation to try anything that might work.
Nick, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
That's Nick Miroff, Washington Post reporter covering the Department of Homeland Security. We talked with him about an ongoing series on the fentanyl crisis. We have a link to that series at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll learn why more women are serving as household breadwinners, more men becoming stay-at-home dads. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.